Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Taking connectivity with you used to involve hauling a personal computer and later a laptop and more recently smartphones and netbooks. Is the latest evolution a tablet? The creators of Apple's new iPad are making that bet. Joining me in the studio to talk about how the way we work and connect is changing is Hooman Radfar of ClearSpring, a content distribution platform. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we're joined by phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts, by Jonathan Zittrain, professor of law at Harvard Law School, and the author of The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Susan.
And from a studio at WGBH in Boston, Josh Bernoff of Forrester Research. He is co-author of Groundswell. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. We invite our listeners to join our conversation in just a bit. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. We take questions also on Facebook and by tweet. Now, we saw this announcement from Steve Jobs of Apple that the iPad is magical and revolutionary. Josh Bernoff, is that how it looks to you?
Well, to be fair, no. It's not. It may be magical in that it's incredible that they can produce a product like this. Some people before it came out were calling it the Jesus tablet. But there's some pretty significant drawbacks, and I think the quest for something that's midway between an iPhone and a computer is still not realized. I don't think that we're going to see that many people using this product.
Jonathan, do you agree with that?
Well, I agree, and except that I would call it revolutionary in the sense that we're converging now all the way back to a computer again. If you add a keyboard to something like the iPad, you have a computer, except that Apple gets to be a gatekeeper as to what code will run on it. So it makes me concerned that we'll have a revolution in control. It'll be much harder to pick what code you run with devices like this, and these devices may start to predominate.
Hooman, what did you think about the unveiling of the iPad?
I think the iPad is a great step in terms of personal computing. That said, I do think that unlike the iPhone, it wasn't a revolution. It was more of a step forward. In terms of the comments that were made with respect to the code, I believe that overall the internet always wins. So if Apple does open up the platform properly, it could become a bigger product for them. If they don't, you know, if you look back at the history of Apple, they weren't the ones who created an ecosystem like Microsoft. Well, I think they'll be subject to those forces again.
When you say the internet always wins, what do you mean?
Well, if you look back historically, you know, AOL, for instance, as a company, did a fantastic job innovating on what the computing experience was for internet users. All of us remember the You've Got Mail, the Instant Messenger. They defined those experiences. Yet today, when you look at it, what is prevailing is the open software stack where there's an open browser that's based on standards. That always tends to win over time.
Jonathan, you said that this advance, this iPad, is also makes the experience more subject to control by the people who are making these devices. Tell us more about that. What are the trends in that?
Well, Apple actually provides a wonderful set of bookends for this. As Hooman was saying, Apple Computer has represented a certain form of openness. It was Steve Jobs, when he was 21 years old, who gave us the Apple II personal computer in 1977. And the thing with the Apple II was, you turn it on, you get this blinking cursor. It's like, okay, what do you want to do next? And you could write your own code or put in anyone else's code in order to do what you wanted to do, and Apple wouldn't have anything to say about it. That's why within 2 years, you have Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston. They write VisiCalc, the first digital spreadsheet ever. And the entire world is like, wow, where have you been all our lives? Apples are flying off the shelves in 1979, and Apple Computer had to do market research to figure out why. And then you look at this bookend that is the iPad. And to me, it's actually quite signal that Apple dropped the word computer from its name. It's just now Apple Inc. And the real move here was starting with the iPod and then the iPhone and now the iPad, where Apple gets to say what runs on the thing. And with the the iPod and then the first version of the iPhone, that meant everything was supposed to come from Apple. It turned out with the iPhone, maybe this is a flavor of openness always wins, some people were so eager to code for the iPhone that they started doing this thing called jailbreaking, where you would actually hack the phone just so you could run your own code. And then within a year, we're now talking 2008, Apple said, okay, we're going to allow outsiders to code for the phone. The only asterisk there, and it's a huge one, is that in order to allow your code to run on the phone, Apple has to bless you and it as the software developer and the software. And my worry is that that is just open enough to lure everybody in. People going to start writing apps, and most of them will get approved by Apple, and that will make consumers favor the devices. But then you've set up this entire architecture so that not only Apple, if it decides it doesn't want any other browser to run on the phone but Safari, which is the case, but the government or multiple governments can then knock on a door at Apple headquarters in Cupertino and say, wait a minute, we don't like the way this app works. We need it yanked. And at that point, Apple won't be able to say anything about it. And we saw an example of that with Amazon's Kindle, which is another similar device where Amazon gets to say what runs on it and what won't. And Amazon has just announced they're going to allow outsiders to code for the Kindle, the e-book reader, but they will get to approve what runs and what doesn't. And at some point recently, they got panicked that 1984, the book 1984, had been distributed without proper rights clearance, and they were able to reach into every Kindle that had downloaded it and delete it.
You know, I've been reading off of Kindle for years as a traveler's device. It's wonderful, but I found that case kind of chilling. Josh Bernhoff, are you concerned about some of these trends?
Yes, I am. I have to admit that when we came up with the idea we used to describe what's happening, we call it the SplinterNet. I was influenced. I had been reading Jonathan's book at the time, and we at Forrester Research help a lot of different kinds of companies. We help content companies. We help marketers. And for 15 years, they've been able to count on the fact that pretty much everything that accesses websites is a computer, and they're all pretty much the same. They have a little different screen sizes, different browsers, but you create one website, and it pretty much works the way you expect it to work. The whole internet, at least the business part of the internet, is based on that, with stuff like click-throughs and search engine optimization and web analytics, all the tools that people use to make sure that websites are working and working right. Well, these new devices, and I just want to take issue with the truism that the internet always wins. Well, the internet may win, but the web now has been splintered. You have tens of millions of these iPhones out there. People are using them far more frequently to access the internet than they would on a computer, and the experience is completely different. All of this infrastructure, the web analytics and so on, that's all got to get rebuilt here. And if you're creating a website or if you're a marketer, you have to worry now, which of these experiences are you trying to optimize, or are we going to actually split what used to be the whole internet into a bunch of little pieces, each a little different for each different device?
Hooman, do you see this SplinterNet coming?
Well, I think it's going to be it's a short-run phenomenon, in my opinion. I think that it will. Again, I'll go back to the Apple computer example. When they first introduced the personal computer, it was a vertically integrated experience. They provided the hardware, they provided the operating system, the applications. And what ended up happening is an ecosystem built around it, and Microsoft changed the game by saying, hey, look, I'm going to focus on one piece. I'm the operating system, and an industry built around the other pieces. If you look at what's happening now with iPhone, wow, it's a repeat of history. They introduced this experience, and guess what? Google is introducing Android, the operating system, and now all the other phones are standardizing on it. So I think it's a short-run phenomenon. In the long run, again, I do believe the internet always wins.
You know, you guys are the big experts on this subject. Tell me what of these devices you routinely use in your daily life. Hooman, what about you?
I have a Kindle, and I also use a BlackBerry.
And Jonathan, what about you?
I've got an iPhone and a Kindle.
And Josh?
The thing is, they're great. I mean, I love them. I make no mistake. They are, from a market perspective, they're fabulous. It's just like they're bad for America, is sort of what I'm saying. And, you know, part of the way I would connect with what Hooman was saying was, you know, if we get the message out, both to software developers, so that maybe they will push back a little bit on some of the onerous requirements coming through the architecture from vendors like Apple and to consumers, so they're actually aware of the spectrum of choices they have. And at the time I got my iPhone, Android wasn't ready yet, so I am ripe for a switch-in, so long as my exit fees aren't too high, that we might well be able to avert the future. And it almost has some resonance with the old Y2K problem of everybody was so concerned about the switch over to the year 2000 and will that fry a bunch of computers that had always assumed the years would begin with 19. Who could have predicted? And then it might be possibly thanks in part to the alarm that was raised that we were able to have a smooth transition because, you know, people heeded the warnings.
Josh, what about you? What do you use?
Well, I could tell you that I have an iPad, but everyone would know I was lying. I'm not important enough to get one. I have an iPhone. I've had two generations of iPhone, and I find it interesting. The one that's no longer used as a phone, my son is using to do little stop-action movies with the photos on it. And I have a Kindle and a Nook, which is the Kindle equivalent device that's available from Barnes & Noble, and I actually also had for a while the Sony Reader, which is another one of these e-reader devices.
You know, all of us have an e-reader. All of us have Kindles, and Josh, you have some of the others too. Now, the iPad, is that going to make these e-readers obsolete? Is that going to be the thing that we want to use to read books on?
Well, there's actually a very big difference between the iPad and these other devices. The other devices use a very unique screen from a company called E-Ink that's right here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's a black and white screen, but it's much easier on the eyes. It can be, and it has a very, very long battery life, very good things for reading books and newspapers and the like. The screen on the iPad is very similar to the screen on an iPhone or any other computer screen. Therefore, it uses up the battery a lot quicker, and reading on there for hours presumably is going to be a little bit more tedious than it would be to read on these special e-ink screens.
Josh Bernoff is Senior Vice President for Idea Development at Forrester Research, and he's co-author of a book called Groundswell. And we're also joined this hour by Jonathan Zittrain and Hooman Radfar as we talk about what next in computing. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And we're talking this hour about the future of computing. With me in the studio, Hooman Radfar from ClearSpring. It's a content distribution platform. Joining us remotely, Jonathan Zittrain, who's a professor at Harvard Law School. He's the co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And Josh Bernoff from Forrester Research. Let's go to the phones. We're going to take some of your calls. 1-800-433-8850. We'll go first to Scott, who's calling us from Indianapolis. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you doing? I have nothing of the expertise that your guests have, but I called to differ with a couple of their thoughts. They were concerned about the openness of the platform or the mechanism by which people get access to use Apple, and my own feeling as someone who's used their products for a long time is if it keeps the glitches out, I'm all in favor of it. I'm actually much more concerned about Google's ability to follow our lives than I am about Apple's. But the primary reason I called was that I heard the same sort of comments with the iPhone. And I certainly the iPad's going to develop, and I'm sure there are particular things about it that aren't going to be what everybody would want. But I see it actually as being just this incredible avenue by which to be an e-reader, to be able to access magazines, newspapers, in a colorful and good presentation. And I'm going to be one of those who think that it's going to take off just like the others.
So, Scott, are you going to buy one?
I sure am. I might wait for the second generation. but I think that Apple's never failed to sort of live up or rarely failed to live up to what they produce, and they've been on such a good run, and their products, I think they know their audience, and I think people are going to find out that others start to get this product. I think people are going to start thinking, well, you know, that really is quite cool, and I'd rather watch my movie in the car on that, or have my kids watch their movie in the car on that. And I just think it's got the potential, because it comes from the basis of the Mac operating system to just grow and develop in a way. And I really do think it's going to be a real threat to Kindle and Nook and other e-readers.
Yeah. Okay. Scott, thanks very much for calling. You know, Josh Bernoff, one of the surprising things from last week's announcement was how affordable the iPad seemed to be, $499 for the lower priced model. Was that a surprise to you?
Yeah, it certainly looked, from all the chatter ahead of time, that people expected it to be more expensive. But people also aren't concentrating on some of the weaknesses. Your caller said that it used the Mac operating system. It actually uses the same operating system or version of the operating system used on the iPhone, which can only run one application at a time, unlike computers. And the browser on there, like the iPhone browser, can't run Adobe Flash, which is present in more than 80% of the websites that people look at. So, yeah, for $499, you got something that maybe in the next generation will be getting to where it needs to be. I found it interesting when we posted this SplinterNet idea on my blog. I had two kinds of people come in. The Apple zealots all said, it's from Apple, it's going to be a success, so don't go dumping on it. And the standard zealots all came in and said, the standards are going to solve everything. All these devices will work exactly the same in the future. So I think we must be in the right place if I'm getting it from both sides.
Well, what of those two sides, what do you think will happen?
Well, I think that, you know, the idea that if Apple creates a device that's a success, they have incredible design skills. They do some amazing things there. Those of us who use iPhones know just how wonderful that device is. But they've made some flops, too. Apple TV is not on the top of everybody's TV set right now. So, no, I think they got some work to do before they get this right. And as far as the standards folks go, there is definitely a trend toward solving some of these incompatibilities between these devices. But if you think that you can design a website that looks great on a normal-sized computer or a laptop, and then if somebody accesses it on a little iPhone, it's going to also work just as well, well, no, you got to think about the differences there. And standards can't make a 3.5-inch iPhone behave like a 17-inch computer screen.
Josh, we've and Hooman, we've moved here at the Diane Rehm Show into new applications like Facebook. There's a Facebook page for the Diane Rehm Show, Twitter. We take questions by tweet. What do you see happening, Hooman, for what's happening now with Twitter? How is that developing?
Well, I think Twitter is indicative of what I like to call the news becoming real time. So what's happening is that citizens are becoming journalists in some respect in 140 characters or less. You know, the co-founders are often very excited about telling stories about, hey, we caught an earthquake before the press, several, you know, different examples like that. So I think it's just indicative of the fact that as people have mobile devices, both photos, comments, and whatnot are going to be accessed in real time. And I think it's actually going to shift the way that the news is presented and how what our expectations are of the timeliness of the news.
Jonathan, we certainly have found that with the earthquake in Haiti, with protest in Iran, where Twitter was sometimes the best way to find out what was going on the ground. What do you think is going to happen with that?
Well, I've been extremely impressed with the uses to which Twitter has been put. I mean, it's the kind of thing that when you first encounter it, you're like, what? This is what the hype is about? You know, and I thought blogs were inane. Wow, this, you know, Twitter is only 140 characters. And then you see the uses to which something, as you might call, as generative as Twitter, that anybody can tweet, and there are all sorts of pieces of software that can plug in to tweet and can receive tweets. And then you see people organizing to do the sorts of things that you hear about earthquake reporting and Iran election coordination and that sort of thing. But I want to draw a line connecting things like Twitter and the Facebook with its applications platform right back to the iPad and the iPhone. All of these things are what I call generative. They allow outsiders to build on them and build surprising new things that the vendor might not have thought about, but they are contingently generative. They are services, not products. And that means in a heartbeat, the rug could be pulled out from under. So it's a little bit worrisome that a platform that is starting to generate as much activity as Twitter is just at Twitter.com. And if Twitter.com goes down someday, all the things that depend on it go down. Ditto for the Facebook applications platform, and ditto for a gatekeeper-style community like that of the Apple iPad and iPhone. And that is really worrisome. It's not like what we had before on the Internet. Say what you like about email, the least not the least of which is that it's full of spam, but email is a totally distributed, it's almost a collective hallucination. There's no single email central processor like there is, say, with the United States Post Office, and that makes it harder for email to go down because it's just different servers talking to one another. And so I think Twitter and Facebook illustrate an overall shift in our ecosystem that I'm not against. You know, it's not like you can command the tides here, but there are some changes they bring with them that we really ought to be systemically dealing with and thinking about and preparing for, rather than just making individual market choices here that say, wow, this stuff is shiny and cool.
Hooman, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, at ClearSpring, we develop a product that's a content distribution platform that lets you share to Facebook and Twitter and whatnot. We have a lot of experience developing on those platforms. So from our perspective as a developer on those platforms, I definitely agree that having dependencies upon any one platform, and that's becoming more and more easy, by the way, can be problematic. That said, I just look at these guys as more bellwethers, if you will, a way to look at them of where things are going. And I think truly and honestly, if people want to communicate in these ways, they'll start to become standardized. They'll start to become distributed. Again, I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow, but I think the economics are going to predicate it. So for instance, if Facebook is failing all the time or Twitter's failing all the time and it has an impact on your business, somebody out there who's a smart entrepreneur is going to say, wait, I'm going to make a version of this that's distributed, or I'll make some sort of solution that will solve that. So, you know, I'm a believer that the reason the internet wins, just to kind of underscore my previous point, is sheer economics.
Let's go to Stephen. He's calling us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Stephen, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning to you, and I'm really pleased to be on. I've thought about getting on before, but never did. I'm in a situation right now, I'm a senior citizen, I'm blind in one eye, and I've got carpal tunnel. All of these beautiful, nice digital devices out there are all designed for people with two eyes and two good hands. And it's one of the elements of the environment and development that I oftentimes see that I'm being ignored, or my situation is being ignored. As in, for instance, 3D movies I can't see because I don't have two good eyes. And with my carpal tunnel, I can't use these mini keyboards. I had been in the industry since the early 60s and before, so I'm quite familiar with computers and that kind of stuff. And I do use a desktop at home.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen, thanks so much for giving us a call. We're glad you got through. Let me ask our panel, what about someone like Stephen who has some disabilities that affect his ability to use some of these devices? Are there ways he can utilize them? Josh, any words for Stephen?
Well, certainly the move to a graphical user interface and a graphical environment with rendered web pages has created some new challenges for some within the community of the disabled. I mean, when being online was like having a teletype, you would type and then it would type back at you and you would type and it would type back at you, that's much more readily translatable into, say, a Braille feed off a ticker tape or some other mode of read it aloud software that's a lot harder to do with web pages. Hard doesn't mean impossible, and of course we wouldn't want to, you know, deny everybody a graphical environment in order to keep a kind of level playing field. But we've seen entities like the World Wide Web Consortium, a nonprofit standard-setting body that develops HTML, the basic unit of the web right now, and they have techniques that webmasters can use so so that with every picture on a website, there's a tag that says, by the way, this is a picture of a dog, or this is a chart, and by the way, here's the data in the chart. And these are the kinds of things that a conscientious webmaster can use to try to encode data so that it can be chopped and sliced in different ways and for different kinds of audiences. Whether or not webmasters choose to avail themselves of these alternatives so that they can put their data into different forms is another question. It's not clear there's enough market demand to have it automatically done, at which point you could see maybe ways of subsidizing it so people get a bonus if they put their websites into these forms, or maybe you have third parties come in and say, we'll start with one website and then do an overlay to make it more accessible to the people we care about.
Jonathan, what's your perspective?
Oh, sorry, that was Jonathan.
Oh, that was Jonathan. I thought that was Josh. Josh, what's
over
your
to you,
perspective?
Well, since Groundswell was published 2 years ago, by the way, I want to thank you guys since it sort of got launched on the Diane Rehm Show. We have been tracking the use of these social technologies, and it just continues to climb. One of the main things we see is that it is reaching an audience that is broadening out to include a lot more people that are in their 40s and 50s and even 60s. But the people who are interested in reaching out and participating in this are the ones that are most active. And I think that as it gets broader, there may be some accommodation made for people who can't interact in the same way. But that's really where the action is. It's in Twitter. It's in Facebook. It's in all of these social technologies. And the media companies and marketers that I work with are intensely interested in interacting with people there. When the consumers go there, the companies that want to reach those consumers are definitely ready to follow them.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. We're also going to read some of your emails. First, let's go to Dan, calling us from Detroit. Dan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to say that I bought a pretty fully featured tablet PC about a year and a half ago that does everything the iPad can do and, you know, a whole lot more. And most of the features it actually has are useless for everyday use. So I'm really not impressed with everything Apple's promised, considering that there's other competing products on the market already or coming out that already do a lot more and they're based on Android.
Well, and what do you use your tablet for?
Grad school. It's my main PC now.
All right. Thanks very much for your call, Dan. Any comments from our panel? Houman?
Well, with respect to the iPad, I think when I look at it, I think it's going to have a different adoption curve than iPhone. I think iPhone was a fundamental communications device priced at, you know, at least a reasonable uptick to a cell phone or smartphone. So it had the ability to take off. iPad was the same thing. I think iPad's going to be in this weird limbo because it's priced just high enough that it has to be compared to a general computing device, but it doesn't really have a huge utility leap, you know, over a laptop or anything like that. So I think people are going to look at it and say, wow, that's cool. And then, you know, I don't think it's going to have the same uptick, at least at the price point where it's at, or price performance, rather.
Does that mean that people will just wait until there's the next generation that includes more of the features and functions that people are looking for?
Well, what's the compelling reason to buy it, I guess, is the question, right? It's as cheap as the Kindle and it does more. It's more expensive than the Kindle, but doesn't quite do anything the laptop does. So I'm curious to see how the market adopts it. My guess is it's not going to be the phenomenon that, you know, iPhone was, where it was just priced and released in such a way that it just took off.
Of course, the compelling reason right now may be just it's the coolest new thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Jonathan. I share Houman's skepticism about it personally, but then I also realize that we underestimate Apple at our peril. I took a walk down memory lane lately and just looked at a web page with reactions to the first announcement of the iPod, the Apple iPod MP3 player. And there's just a bunch of people in this message board saying, we don't get it. It's a really expensive MP3 player. Why would you pay four times as much money for something with slightly fewer features than what's already out there? And, of course, there was just some kind of gestalt to it, just, you know, this wonderful Steve Jobsian totality to it that just makes it appealing in a way that stuff with, you know, better features sometimes just isn't.
Yeah, Susan, let me respond to that. Among the people who ran down the original iPod were Forrester Research. So what we don't remember is that when it came out, there was no iTunes, which is actually a pretty important part of making that into a useful product. And it was not until the iTunes software came out that the thing became successful. When you look at the iPad, the question you want to ask yourself is this a creation device or is it a consumption device? And as a creation device, it's definitely limited. It doesn't have a camera in it. The keyboard, you have to type on the screen with a screen-based keyboard. It's not real good at that. If it comes to consuming things, which is sort of what you do with an iPod, if you're consuming movies, well, you know, it's the wrong aspect ratio. It's 4:3 instead of that widescreen that HDTV movies come in. And it's not going to have a battery life of a Kindle when it comes to consuming books. Now, this is the coolest device ever, at least until the next cool device comes out. But I'd sort of like to see some of these challenges fixed so it's either a great consuming device or a device that can actually be used to create content and interact better.
Uman, do you agree?
I definitely agree with a lot of the comments that were made. Again, when I look at it, iPod, there's a fundamental need for people to have a music player. So regardless of whether iPod succeeded or not, somebody was going to win, so they won that space. Same thing with the phone market. What's the fundamental need that iPad is solving? And I think the way that he phrased it was great. It's definitely not a great content generation tool. From a consumption perspective, it's great. But, you know, as a user of Kindle, for instance, the price performance is good. It's, you know, $199.
We're going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones and take some of your calls and questions and read your emails as we continue our conversation about what's next in the world of computing. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by PBS, presenting the National Parks, America's Best Idea, from filmmaker Ken Burns, airing tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
Colin Firth was just nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in A Single Man, playing a college professor whose longtime lover has died.
Everything's actually falling apart completely inside. But I think if he gives in to hysterical misery, then it'll become real, and he's not ready for that.
We'll talk with Colin Firth on the next Fresh Air.
We've got a lot of people patiently waiting on the phones. Let's go to one of them, Randy. He's calling us from Jacksonville Beach, Florida. Randy, hi. Thanks for holding on.
Sure. Thank you. I was calling to see when you guys feel the impact of the iPad and the Kindle will take effect with the elementary and middle level school libraries across the country. I mean, 10 years from now, where there'll be school libraries with hardcover books.
Randy, interesting question. Do you work in a school library yourself?
I work in that market.
Uh-huh.
The particular market.
What kind of impact, let me ask the panel, what kind of impact has it had already in elementary, middle school libraries and classrooms? Has it had much? Jonathan,
you know what?
Or whoever would be the person that's able to answer?
This is Josh. You know, one of the things we see, we've been looking at media and changes in media for decades now at Forrester, and things don't evaporate very quickly, but you can often tell the change is coming long before it comes. And if you look at what's happening to newspapers right now, you know, 5 years ago, you could say, you know, it looks like these guys are going to have a problem. They're going to lose their classifieds and their readers keep getting older. And it's like, no, everything's fine. It's fine. Oh, my God, it's a disaster. Well, I think the book business is suffering in a similar way now. And, you know, are we still going to have libraries full of books 10 years from now? Absolutely. That's not going away.
Why isn't that going away?
Well, it's just that there's the book happens to be a really great way to deliver content, and none of these other devices have quite gotten to the point where they have the simplicity of just being able to carry something, can read it in any light, never runs out of battery life, and so on. And yet, there will be an effect. And, I mean, as an author now, we see this. The publishers I deal with are very concerned because the prices of these books in electronic format are a whole lot lower. The profit for them is lower. Of course, they don't have to manufacture the books, which is an enormous plus. In fact, if you look at the sort of the thin end of the wedge here, it's not in high schools or elementary schools. It's in colleges where, you know, $150 textbook, it's like, oh, well, forget that. I'm just going to download it electronically. And that is where you're likely to see this change start and spread, is in the college textbook business, and then work its way out through trade books and eventually through places like elementary and high schools.
You know, as the parent of a kid who's in college, by paying for those $150 textbooks that are then obsolete about 6 months later, I would be all in favor of more of these kind of innovations, Jonathan. I mean, I think, it seems to me it also has the advantages of being, if you were just downloading textbooks instead of having to buy them, they could be updated, they could have interactive graphics, a lot of advantages. At Harvard, where you teach, is that happening? Are professors still requiring students to buy the traditional textbook?
Well, I come from a place where when they finally started wiring the classrooms around 1998 or so, the very first thing they did once there was Ethernet to every desk was turn it off, because they're afraid people would just sit and not just play solitaire, but, you know, partypoker.com all day. But I take your point that there are so many opportunities here in the educational space to not just make it, as Josh was describing before with respect to the iPad, consumptive, but to actually let the kids interact with one another, interact with kids in classrooms very far away who happen to be reading the same materials and reacting maybe from a very different perspective. When you network things together, all sorts of really interesting things can happen. And my guess is that just the way that my school reacted initially so negatively to just the fact of Ethernet, there have been a number of schools that have reacted negatively to the presence of Wikipedia. You know, boy, you can't cite this thing. It's going to say one thing one moment, another thing the next, and, you know, no expert weighed in on it. But the next step may be to get people to think about how to use the process of Wikipedia, where people actually argue about what should be in an entry and what should be out of it and make their cases and try to persuade each other, that that's actually part of what we want our kids to learn as part of a kind of liberal arts education starting in elementary and secondary schools. So I see a lot of possibility using the network space. I just balance that with this worry that has been present throughout of this shift from product to service. So going back to your original question of books in the library, and will we still have libraries with, you know, books in them? Maybe a few for show or to give you a feel that you're in a library. The books signal that. But if the project as ambitious as the Google Books project works, the whole idea would be, why as a library, a school library with a limited budget, would you be wanting to spend it on books in the offhand hope that some kid will want to take the book out and then another kid can't have it till she returns it? Why not do something like have a big database and then the kids use whatever screen they can find and are able to access all of humankind's knowledge in books? The only drawback is, because it's a service and not a product, it means that a book that is found objectionable, copyright infringing, defamatory, pornographic, you name it, it's not like this hasn't happened, a judge can now sign an order, direct it to the likes of Google, which in good faith has been building this corpus of stuff, this database, and out it goes. And when it goes out of there or gets altered there, it affects every copy around the world that accesses that database. So something that we would not accept with a library. Can you imagine the library police kicking down the door and removing books? You know, that's somehow a step way too far over just not allowing publication, further publication of contraband. Suddenly, you are much more empowered as a regulator to do that because of the network.
Big topic. Human, I know you deal a lot with social networks, and Jonathan just talked about the possibility of having students all around the world who are studying the same thing, having some ability to communicate with one another. What do you see happening when it comes to social networks and the expectations of sharing, being able to share them?
I think that's a great point. What we've seen and our platform is geared towards sharing is that the web has intrinsically become social. So there was this phenomenon a couple of years ago, and I think people are still fixated on this concept that there are social networks. Facebook is a social network. Guess what? That concept is going away because every single website is now becoming social. Because Facebook is becoming a platform, because Twitter is becoming a platform, you know, you have all these people, you know, admittedly a lot of them are gaming providers and entertainment type providers at the beginning that are enabling their sites to be social. To draw the, you know, corollary to the education space, what you're seeing, college freshmen, for instance, when they want to work together, they Facebook each other. They don't use an email address, and I'll remember this quote forever. My little brother, well, one of my little brothers, was in college, and he was starting Georgia Tech, and he said to me, there's two things that every college freshman gets. Number one, an email address. Number two, Facebook. And the reason they want their email is so they can get Facebook. So I think the expectation is that people can share socially in every application.
Here's an interesting email we've gotten. This person writes, I live in Ozark County, Missouri, and high-speed internet is still not available for many of us in this unimportant area. Cell phones don't work in my house. I have to go outside to find a signal. The governor wants to get rural Missouri connected, but I just heard that state legislators have cut that funding. I would have to go satellite for a faster connection, but am retired and can't afford it. So with all these new devices, they're a joke for me. Will I be forgotten and ignored forever? Jonathan, I wonder how many Americans continue to be have trouble kind of joining this world we've been talking about this hour.
Well, Josh may have some good numbers on the digital divide question. Josh, do you have some stuff at hand?
I don't have numbers, but I can tell you that in general, once you get to the point where 70 or 80% of the people are participating, private business doesn't worry about the rest of it. So, you know, if you're selling toilet paper through through a website, or you're providing Google information service, the fact that 80% of consumers are online and that well over half of them are online broadband is good enough for you. In general, it's left to governments at that point. And there was a time when there was a big push to get rural broadband happening, because for the economics for somebody like a cable or a telephone company to reach out to people in Ozark is not that good. They have to run a lot of wires to reach a relatively small number of people. But I think given what's happening with government budgets these days, you're likely to see a continuation of the frustration this caller or this emailer is experiencing. Because,
Josh?
I think we lost him.
I think we lost Josh. So that is a very, I'm sure, discouraging message to our emailer who wants to be part of this and is just having these technological difficulties because of where he lives.
Yeah, I think when you look back historically, he was making a great point. There was this principle of universal access where they would subsidize, you know, on the phone company basis. I think when you look at it from a private industry perspective, obviously the economics dictate where they're going to go. So they're going to attack the affluent markets, which tend to have, you know, high access and be in cities. I do think there are a number of technologies that are coming up. When you look at WiMAX and some other alternatives, which are longer range, high bandwidth, which could potentially mitigate that problem. So there definitely is a bright side there.
Let's go back. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jonathan.
I just think what it reminds us of is that, you know, we're not talking about standard consumer goods here. We're talking about the information backbone of our society. And it's worth remembering that the Internet itself was forged out of an unlikely corner. It didn't come from standard market forces. It came from some government subsidies and some scientists who invented stuff and then amazingly chose not to patent it. They chose to give it away to the world for free. And then you had the commercial forces, including internet service providers, finding a way to build it out using a standard market profit model so that more and more people could have it, not just those in universities or government facilities. So I think it's sort of a useful reminder that as we really start to see the benefits and implications of this technology spreading, it's probably going to continue to be some hybrid. We want to harness market forces and know just what magic can be wrought there. But at the same time, if there are people left behind, if there are larger public policy issues, we need some mechanism by which to think them through and, as appropriate, to allow those left behind to be brought along.
All right. Let's go to Kevin calling us from Mastic, New York. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm actually on the bus going to college right now, and I'm a computer science major, so all of this stuff matters to me. I'd just like to ask one question because, you know, I don't fall for the whole Apple hype thing. I have a BlackBerry, just like one of the guests said, and, you know, I use a lossless media player because I can't stand MP3s, and I just don't follow the hype. So by everyone else following the Apple hype, with some of its technological constrictions, like, you know, they didn't have the Core i7 in their iMacs until, like, last year. How much is society giving up to follow the fad, you know?
All right, Kevin, thanks for your call. Any response from our panel?
I would respond to that just because I guess my background's very similar to his. I would agree with the comment that there are some things lacking there, but if I were you, I would look at it as, if you look historically, there's always someone who defines the market. Apple tends to do that quite a bit in the personal computer industry. That doesn't necessarily mean that by defining the market, they get to own the market. There will be a broader ecosystem as long as there's a consumer demand. And I think the hype is actually could be a good thing because what Apple said is our personal computing experience on mobile has to be better. And now there's a ton of people, cell phone manufacturers, wireless providers, et cetera, who are trying to say, okay, I believe you that that's the experience. Now let me commoditize that and make it more affordable for the masses.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Josh, were you trying to get in?
Yeah, I want to talk about the inevitability of Apple success. You know, there was a time when only the Yankees could win the World Series, but eventually things change, and Apple as a company doesn't take a whole lot of input from outside. In contrast to other companies, it's very closed down. In fact, at Apple, you're not allowed to issue public statements unless you're one of about 7 or 8 of the employees there. You can probably get fired for that. So that only works if you're brilliant. And Apple is more consistently brilliant than any other company on the planet. But, you know, not every product is going to be a hit. And I think there is room for innovation here, especially in some of these spaces where they haven't quite gotten to the right form factor or the right kinds of features just yet. So just because it says Apple on the side doesn't mean they're going to win any more than just because it says Yankees on the team means they're going to win the World Series.
All right. Let's talk to Jane calling us from St. Louis. Jane, hi.
Hi. I'm a novice at computers, but what strikes me is the statement that this is both radical and magical. I consider what they're doing very dangerous. What he's doing or what they're doing with this iPod is, frankly, a Swiss Army knife. Now, is everyone too young to remember what Swiss Army knives were? It's an old concept. It's a borrowed idea. It's not radical, except that in this case, they're bundling a number of functions, communication functions, under one, as they say, mega system or one roof. That's owned and controlled by a corporation, which is for profit, not for your benefit. And I wouldn't put those communication functions under the control of one government, let alone a rival government that I have no voice in, which is similar to the banking industry now, and it's a concern for the public.
Jane, thanks so much for your interesting point. Go ahead.
Let me just draw a parallel here. You know, think about Disney World. When you go into Disney World, you know what the rules are. It's a fun place. There's lots of different things to do. But if you start behaving the wrong way, they'll throw you out because the government of Disney World is Disney. It's not a place where free expression is encouraged. And Disney World's a fine place to go for a while, but some of the time you actually want to be able to do whatever you feel like in your own home or in your own community. It's the same thing here. You got, if you're working on the iPhone, the apps on there are the apps they approve. If they don't like the app, it doesn't get on there. And it's a wonderful environment. You can do a lot of stuff there, but I think that there's certainly an opportunity for things that are a little bit more open and allow a little bit more choice, just like people that want to spend all their time in Disney World.
I think the consumer ultimately is going to drive where this goes. So if you will tell everyone where to go with the dollars. I think often people have this mistaken perception that corporations will control people. I believe, obviously, they're going to do what's best for the corporation. But at the end of the day, they're driven by profit. And if consumers ultimately say, hey, look, I can go get an Android device, you know, versus Apple, it does 80-20 the same thing, and it's cheaper, guess what? They're going to go there. Or if applications can run in multiple places and that ends up being cheaper for the developer, that's what's going to happen. To respond to your bundle comment, just maybe this will give you some comfort. They are already having trouble with that controlled environment with applications like Google Voice. They didn't want Google Voice on top of Apple, and they received a huge amount of flack. So I think it'll break open sooner than you think.
Hooman Radfar, Jonathan Zittrain, and Josh Bernoff, thank you so much for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Thanks. Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.